Two Pints in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. This is Two Pints in a Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony is getting better. He's still not with us right now, but he will be in a few months, I expect. We hope, because he's got a lot to say. But today, we have our guest interviewer, is Sean McNally again, which is wonderful. And we're addressing with Sal Baglio from the Stampers, and he's going to talk about the cruise. So welcome to Two Pints in a Corner again, Sal and Sean.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, Dinky, thank you so much, man. I mean, listen, we're going to talk about cruise. Who knows better than you?
Well,
you are the history of road cruise, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I was the roadie, and now, and that's what every one of us are that worked with you. Work with our artists. Every one of us are roadies. Now, we do spring off into our different genres of stuff that we like to do, and I love to do the mixing, and that's what turned me into a mixing guy. And other friends of mine turned into light guys and stuff like that. And that's what we want to talk about, is how the roadies, because in that time when you first started, everybody was called roadies. There was no... personal, there was no this, there was no that, you know, I mean, they hadn't determined different jobs, we just did everything.
and I think at that time, I think that the guys that did that job, that word wasn't a slight in any way.
No.
In fact, I think they wore it, I think they wore it very proudly, you know.
Absolutely.
Exactly, Sean.
At least the guys that I worked with, you know, for sure.
It's funny because it kind of started out with, you know, back in those days, it's like, you know, hey, your buddy, let me carry your guitar in for you, or let me help you guys out, and I'll get free beers. That was really about the extent of it.
And then absolutely, Sean.
It really became an industry in itself after, over time, as the specialized stuff started to come in, and, you know, you had guys who could get guitar tech and drum tech, and guys who would be front of house, you have lighting guys, so... It really kind of expanded, and some of those guys who were just kind of friends of the bands actually became legitimate professional guys if they wanted to. Well, and there was definitely opportunities for them out there.
Well, that was more in the 80s than it was in the 70s. The 70s were just straight roadies. Everybody just did everything they could to make a show happen and put it on, whatever it is, you know. In the 80s, it came more refined, I think. I think there was still a lot of individual stuff going on, but there was stuff that person can do better than me on that job, so let's hire him or her to do this job, and let's talk about some of those that you had. Start with you, Sal, because that's an important thing for a musician to talk about, the backline roadies, the frontline roadies, the hair making roadies, the running around roadies.
Oh man,
I did hair makeup. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Most of them did a little bit of everything.
You know? Exactly.
There were many. We had many. You know, there were lots of crew guys came and went. Some get forgotten in the blur of time. You know, but road crews were and are an important, essential part of the Stompers' history. And any band, really.
That's true, Sal.
We're talking about that in particular. Essential. And to get the band up and running.
Yes.
You know, the sound, lights, guitar, drum tech, all essential to putting on the show. And not to mention being right there in the tornado of drama. You know, because besides their job, they had to deal with the venue staff, you know, unscrupulous people not paying them, whatever. And then, Dinky, and I know you guys know this, the hurricane of artist self-absorption. You know, can I get more me in the monitor? That's great.
I love that line.
I love it.
I'm sure I've said it many times, but the more I think of that line, it's like, can you get more? Can I please get more me in the monitor? Well, where's the dressing room? More importantly, where's the bathroom? The crew guys, they had to know all of that stuff on top of, doing the gig.
But they
so when I say they are essential, and very rarely did they get any applause, I tried desperately to make it a point to thank them from the stage every night. But sometimes, in the blur of live rock and roll, I might have forgotten, And for that, I apologize, because they were really, really very important,
So let's talk about individuals. Let's talk about
absolutely
Zeus and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it has to start with the first roadie we ever had, and that would be Eddie McGee.
Eddie McGee.
Oh, yeah.
Eddie came to us. We the Stomper started, I think, November of 77. So he, I want to say, came to us in, January of 78 when we got our first road guy. And it was like, it was just an amazing thing, because we were moving gear, and he's like, I'm gonna take care of that from now on. And and it was Eddie McGee and another gentleman who is sadly passed away, named Tommy Bracey. And they were our road crew in the very beginning. And Eddie was, they did everything. So, yeah. Like you were saying, Dink, nobody had a specific job. It was like lugging, set it up, guitar tech, lighting, sound, monitor, whatever everything. It was back then, And so Eddie came to us at the very beginning, and he was he turned into my guitar tech for a long time. And then he eventually moved to front of the house.
Wow.
And he was with us for our very last show that we played a few years back.
The Bill Run. That was such a name of that. Wow.
Yep. Eddie has been, he's really a brother to me.
Yeah.
And, and there were times during our long 40-something year history where, he might pick up a tour with somebody. I'm going out with Joe Perry for a while, and so we'd get somebody else to fill in and stuff.
Yeah.
But he always came back, and he was always a dear brother to us, And he brought Zeus in.
Yeah.
So Zeus, who of course his real name is Natale Fiescanaro, named Zeus. you'll have to ask him who named him.
It's funny, Sal. I actually messaged him last night about having him join the call today. He would love to, but he's actually working still occasionally, so he can't do today. But he'll be on a future episode for sure. But to the same point, the last Stomper show at Bull
he
Run, which is always a sold show. He was your crew guy that night as well, closing up his last show we ever did.
Absolutely, and he's a long time close brother to the band, Zeus, and. He would go off and work with, Peter Wolf and different bands, Charlie Farron, and then always make it back to us, But Eddie brought him in. I believe Zeus was 18 years old when he started to work for us. And, like you brought up, he was there to hand me my guitar on the very last Stomper show. And as it should be, both he and Eddie were there. Great guys. Yeah. Yeah. John Philbrick was another one. Now, John, Eddie brought him in as well. See, Eddie brought a lot of people into the crew, But John Philbrick, he was with us during the 80s for a bit, and then he moved out to the West Coast. But he was my guitar tech for a long time. He moved to the West Coast. He became Waddy Wachtel's guitar tech.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he still is. And then he worked for Adam Sandler's company, Happy Madison. And he was instrumental in getting my music into a couple of Adam's movies, So, this is like, years, decades later, decades later, this all happened, you know, and he's a very close dear friend of the band still, you know, he and I talk all the time. And so, you know, these guys are, you know, like I said, some people came and went, and others made a really impact on the band and on me personally, you know, and definitely Eddie Zusa, John were three of those. Jay Mackin, I don't know if you remember Jay. Jay originally was working for a company called Spectrum Sound and Light.
Oh, yeah.
And we hired him to come out with us. I think he started out on monitors, which probably gave him a nervous breakdown. Can I get for me in the monitor? You know, at that time, I used to like, I wanted echo in my monitor, not reverb.
Echo.
Not reverb. I wanted, echo. You know, like rockabilly echo in my monitor. And he used to get it. And anyway, and he went from monitors to front of the house, which I think maybe, you know, added longevity to his life. So Jay was at our last show as well. I mean, he I don't think he was working, but he came to hang out and said, if you need anything, just shout my name. And that's really something
that's great.
Like that, just the closeness of these guys, that, you know?
That's the thing.
It's amazing.
So I'll tell you a little story on me with my, just starting with Fleetwood Mac in 1968. We were playing in this bar upstairs in London. I mean, I'm talking upstairs when you had to take the gear up there. It was no stage. People were sat on the on what was stage. I mean, you know. Anyway, this young lad, I didn't know who he was. He came and he says, who are you? He says, I'm Danny. I go, oh, okay. And I didn't realize this was the new member of the band. But he says, I'm here to help you. I says, what do you mean?
Oh, wow.
Lug the gear and this, that, and the other. He says, yeah, come on, I'll take it upstairs with you. I'll do this, that, and the other. I says, no, you don't do any of that. I'm the roadie. You are the musician. And I said, this is what you do. Very simple. You're going to tell me where you want this stuff placed for not only you, but for where everybody else is. Because nobody explained to me where they stood or sat or whatever, you know. And he says, I'll help you do all that. So between us, we dragged all this gear up this damn... Oh, it was awful stairs. And we dragged it up. We set it all up and what have you. And he showed me where to set up Peter's guitar stack and John's stack and then his, Jeremy's. He wanted to be the opposite side of Peter so Peter and him could play together, you know, that kind of thing. He was being weaned Amazing. By Peter. And then... I set all this stuff up and the boys came in. The rest of them were all coming upstairs and I got, Dinky, how did you know? I says, because this gentleman here, he's been helping me with the gear. I told him he shouldn't. He's a musician. He says, and Mick, this is Mick Fleetwood telling me, Danny, you should just listen to him. He knows what he's talking about. I had no idea what I was talking about. It was the first gig I ever did, you know, with this lot. And I says, Danny had the more idea of where you set up, and look, it's really good. He says, yeah, but I didn't probably get your drums right, Danny says. I says, hey, we did our best, Mick. He says, well, there was only one thing to move. And I says, oh, that's pretty good. We did all right then. We knew what we were doing. But after the show, and the biggest thing was after the show, I started taking the gear, put it back in the van and this, that, and the other. And they're down, all the band and the manager and everybody's downstairs in the pub. Having a drink, because it's closed by now, you know, the pub's all closed and we're all having an after drink and whatever. And I got a big applause from Clifford, Dinker, come here, yeah. Dinker. I says, oh my God, here we go. And I says, what? He says, you did well. I says, no, it was all Danny. It was Danny that told me how this worked and that worked, because I never got anything from the boys because they were all scattered around London. I couldn't even talk with everybody, you know. As it was, amazing. When I later on, it took me probably 2 hours just to pick them up to go to a gig, because that's how far apart from one was in Putney, one was in Notting Hill Gate, one was other side of London. You know, it was just picking them up and putting them in the van with me. And what
I have a question for you. So you, when you were out with Mac and Steely Dan and whatnot, like what were some of the size of some of the, I mean, this was the early days, right? So not like, you know, some of these tours today have like hundreds of guys in a row with them. But back then, when you were out with those kind of bands, like who was out there? How many guys on the road with you between doing sound, monitors, light, if anybody, or just roadie work?
Just me. Just
really?
Just That's me. With, not with Steely Dan, but with Fleetwood Mac, because Steely Dan was a whole different ball game. It was 74 we went out with Steely. 72 is when the first open for the Kinks in San Antonio, and that's when I first met them. But the thing is just me, and eventually I got so tired I drove over. You know how we have roundabouts in England with these big signs that say keep left. Well,
yeah,
I went straight through one of them, took the sign with me all the way to London underneath the truck. I didn't even know it was. I just kept going. But I was getting tired, so. Mick was all freaked out. Jeremy's saying, "Oh, Dinky, they killed us, man. What's the deal? We needed another." So we got another driver from London, a Cockney. And we had a driver. That's all he did was drive because he wouldn't be able to set up. And then I saw Chris Adamson, who was the roadie for Peter Frampton at the time. And I said, "I'm going to try and get Clifford to get you in here with us. Would you come with us?" He says, "Oh, yeah." And he did... He's the guy that you gotta have your meat before you have your pudding on, you know, on the old Pink Floyd album and stuff.
Oh, yeah, wow.
So, this is what roadies did, but Peter Frampton, we didn't want him to go because he was the king of all roadies in respect to that time period in '68 because he had the biggest van in the whole thing that went the fastest. It was over 120 mile an hour. He could get out of that damn van, no problem. And coming from Newcastle to Sheffield was about an hour and a half instead of 5 hours. It was just how it was done. We were bad. We were very bad, and we were very good at the same time. But then when Dennis came along, he couldn't do it, so I had to have Chris, and Chris and I just did everything together. Remember, Sal, there was no monitors at that time. Bobby Pridden got the monitors from The Who for... through this thing, and I started using the Wemmers monitors in front of them. I'd lay columns down, and so they had four columns across the front of the stage. I could blast them to death if I wanted to, you know, with just the sheer power of sound and quality. But they didn't worry. Peter kept saying, "I don't need a damn monitor. I sing through the mic, and I hear what the hall's going to give me. And if you do a good mix, then it'll be cool." And I said, "Oh, thank you. I will do that." And that's what happened at places like Fillmore West, Fillmore East, Fillmore West. Fillmore East, I blew it apart one night, absolutely, with Fleetwood Mac. The people in the audience are flipping out. And I said, "You know, I'm having a good time. I've never done this before in front. It's the first time. But it's looking after the group. We were looking after the group. I'd run around. It's like running around for people that need sanitary pads in the middle of the night, you know, that kind of thing for ladies, you know, that worked in our bands and whatever. Yeah. And stuff. Yeah, we were chief cook and bottle washers. You had, in the 80s, you had specific guys that could move on, like you said, Sal, from just lugging gear and setting up and this, that, and the other, to refinement, to monitors, to house, to lighting. And they all still pitched in afterwards to load the gear up and put it back in the truck, and you're out of there, you know.
Sure.
It's time for you to go on with it now because I've rambled. But the bottom line is that's how it all started. Now it's such a refined thing. We have a friend who's actually the guitar tech. He was doing Bruce Springsteen. He's out of Manamet. This kid. And he left Bruce Springsteen because Bruce was really hard to work with in a lot of ways, you know, because he wanted a younger band. And he's been out with Eddie Vara, the guys on the West Coast. I forget the name. You know, the punk guys that came out of Seattle.
Oh, yeah. I know who you mean.
It wasn't Nirvana. It was the other group, not Nirvana, but the other one.
Sam or Soundgarden?
Yeah. No,
Pearl Jam.
Pearl Jam. That's it. He's doing the guitars for Pearl Jam now. Because the people are really good. It's like you, Sal. You really took care of everybody. You know, you had them under your wing. They had you under the wing, too, to be able to get things together and done right for you on stage. The first thing I was ever told as a roadie was make sure that everybody had a glass full on stage.
Yeah, well, we know what that turned into in the 80s. But I regret. You know what happened in the 80s was everybody got a satin jacket that changed everything. You know what I mean? Once those jackets came out, everybody had to get one of those jackets. But, you know, hearing you talk about the early days with Fleetwood Mac, I'm thinking to myself, and you were talking about no monitors and all that. How about Mal Evans? The Beatles had one roadie. It was Mal Evans. And when they first came here, Ringo was moving his own drum riser around at that Washington gig that they did. So, yeah, we've come quite a way since then, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no monitors for vocals. They had the Voxes.
Absolutely.
They had Vox columns lined up, on the top of the roof that day, because that was the first time they were using them in there. But when you got them in the shows, there were no monitors. There was just a couple of Vox columns just for vocals. And you couldn't hear them anyway, you know. It's just the girls would scream and you couldn't hear a damn thing, you know. Did you play that chord or was it? Did I make a mistake on that song? but you just go up there and have fun. And when you have fun, the people that's working with you have fun with you. And not only that, they say, wow, we did a great show tonight. And the respect is amazing. You know, we'd drive away after a show like that. I say, wow, that was good. And something that happened in that particular venue or something that happened at that show that turned you on, and some of them, well, you would go, oh, shit, that was awful. Why did I do that? You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Why did I fight with my manager? Why did I fight with my roadies? Well, it's nature of the beast. You get in there and all of a sudden they're the easiest ones to get yelled at.
I know. Yep, you're right. No glory and all the heat comes down on you. But God, where would we be without them, you know?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we had Martin Favor on a few weeks ago. He was the lighting guy at the channel after DB, you know, one of the real top ones there. But he was doing groups like Extreme. Well, he still is. And not only is he doing groups like Extreme by programming massive amounts of lights for them and having a great show, he's now programming lights for about 80% of the metal bands in this country.
Yeah.
Because he's got the gift. And they love what he's doing and he respects them. And he respects the music, and he's designing it with them. And when they see somebody post something on YouTube about that particular show, and he sees a video from the show, and the group call him up and say, wow, that was pretty good, Martin. That part of it sucks. What are you going to do? You're going to change it?
Yeah.
But it's how you, that's how you work. That's how you create together, because you're all one for that particular show. It's not just, you know, I mean, a meticulous book show like we used to do with, Carol Channing and people like that and stuff like that as a book show. But, you know, which you read a book and there's the mic comes on. You turn the mic on. You turn it off. It's unbelievable.
What,
exactly. If they don't know that kind of stuff, then you shouldn't be doing it. But these people that you know and I know, they did an incredible job. There was a wonderful girl that used to come through the channel that did all the drums and stuff and everybody, and she was really good. And
Laurie,
that's it. That's why.
Yeah, she's still around.
Oh my, Sean. Oh my.
I don't know if she's still working, but she's. I know. I think she's still on social. I see her on Facebook occasionally. I think she's still. I don't know if she's doing music anymore, but she's definitely still around. And yeah, she was in a ton of gigs back then. My goodness.
She did. And your crew too, Sal. Your crew was doing different gigs at the same time, or coming in to see people. I can remember Zeus coming in to see.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. You know, you're talking about the programmed lighting.
Yeah.
Back in our day, that was way before. That was way before that, but we were really lucky. We had some great LDs, you know. You remember, I don't know if you remember Ed Hyatt. Now, Ed Hyatt, he was an LD for us, but also was like the tour manager. It was in that period of time where we were doing a lot of shows. And Ed Hyatt, we nicknamed him the Moon Hoodlum because for some reason or other, he liked to moon people. And I once saw him setting up lights completely naked. He was on a ladder. I think we were playing a show with Steppenwolf. And we never played with him again after that. But Ed Hyatt was a great guy like that. And, of course, Woody Bavoda did lights for us for a long time. Very intuitive light guy, LD. But back in those days, they were called the light guy.
Yeah.
Very intuitive. You know, he listened to the songs, and he's still doing lights today at the Spire in Plymouth, where Eddie McGee is the front of the house. The house guy.
Yep.
They both exactly work right. for the house, and they're both great, still working wonderful. But the top guy, the best guy we ever had was the late DB.
Wonderful.
Instinctive, old school,
wonderful
lighting guy.
I worked with him with Jay Giles, and not just the channel.
Yeah, man.
And let me tell you, he was wonderful, not only as a light guy, but as a person.
He was about as old school as you could get, and his allegiance was to the Jay Giles band.
Yeah.
He didn't tour with anybody else. He toured with them, and when he wasn't touring with them, he worked with us, and we were happy to have him.
Yeah,
I've got stories I can't even tell about stuff, you know.
You get people in trouble.
His soul, and he was just a great LD. I didn't have to ever ask for anything from him. You know, he just
did it.
He was one of those other guys, like you say, Sal, that really took pride in his job. I remember up to changing the gels and moving the cans around when he had the shows coming, because he knew the music, and he didn't want to just say, press a program, let's just do its own lights. He really paid attention and took care of that, and he really took a lot of pride in that.
He did.
Absolutely.
He did.
Absolutely.
And at that point, he'd only had, 24 lights to deal with in the channel. But what he did with that 24 lights was sensational for you guys. I mean, and then he lit up the front of the stage with his six spotlight things. And I mean, it was, he knew how to dress a stage really well and work with the music, work with the dimension of the music, changing the colors in the right time period, the dimming in the right time with the music. No, it was great to work with every time when I did with the Guile stuff. It was just wonderful. And then when he came in,
if he was the LD at the channel, whether it was someone bringing in their own people or just you were lucky to play as a good support band before the Stompers, like that, he really, the band's got a nice, real unexpected bonus because he really did take it seriously and did listen to the music and the different spot. He would know the band from seeing them over the years. He knew, like, okay, I'm going to do something different. This part of the song happens. And he really did take a lot of pride in that. And I give him a lot of credit for that.
American Fun, he went nuts on. He used to go nuts on that song, American Fun of Yours, you know what I mean?
He was great. He, all our guys, were instrumental in our success, you know. You know, another light guy we had for a short time, though, because you'll as soon as I say his name, you'll know what he's doing now. But for a period of time, Elwood Francis worked for us. Now, Elwood, he did lights and he did other stuff, you know. And, of course, he became Billy Gibbons' guitar tech for years. And now he's playing bass for ZZ Top, after the Dusty Hill passed away.
Yeah.
Elwood is the bass player for ZZ Top. But for a short time, he worked with us, and he was just he was from Texas. He was just a great guy. You know, he was a musician himself. He could play well, you know, and he's infamous for it was our keyboard player, Dave Friedman's 30th birthday. He was older than any of us. So yeah. he hit 30. He was the first guy in the band to hit 30. And Elwood, we didn't use, you know, smoke machines and flash pots and all that. Dude. But for Dave's birthday, we got a flash pot.
Oh, no.
And I said, you got to put it under his keyboard.
No.
And then, you know, when I give you the signal, you know, well, he packed that thing with so much powder that when we went into American Fun, boom, 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 keyboard, boom, the band hit. He hit that thing. Boom. You couldn't even see Dave. You couldn't find him. He was in a cloud of flash pot powder, and all you heard was woo. It was hilarious. And that's what Elwood was like. That, you know, another thing he used to do all the time, besides being a great road crew member, was he used to like to solder. He had a soldering gun. He used to solder everybody's clothes bag. So, and he'd do it like so. So you already use your clothes. You're coming back, and you want to get your stuff to put back in to go. You know, and it would be molded. It would be soldered shut. Your clothes bags, your carry bags, and it was like Elwood. And then he'd come in, and he'd have to undo it all. You know, crazy stuff like that, you know.
But that's
you know, you're like a real family with your crew guys. That's for sure.
That's fun, and it's harmless, except for the powder. Except for the powder.
Yeah.
Because we used to have some road crews that would come through the channel that were overkill on the pyro, overkill on this, that, and the other. You know, and it wasn't. It took a completely away from the show, you know, from the music, and the music sort of really suffered at that point, you know. And these are good bands. I said, that's overdone. Look at that. The stuff, all these people are covered in shit. It's kind of like, oh dear. Sean used to, he used to get on there and have fun with these guys and tell them off and stuff. But we don't do that in the channel. We don't. It's like Gibby from the Butthole Surfers setting fire to the damn, setting fire to the cymbal, hitting the cymbal with a stick, and so the fire would go everywhere, you know. And then that's like 2 weeks before the thing happened down in Rhode Island with the
station. Oh God, yeah.
But we'd taken the ceiling down in the channel. I just wanted a raw, funky place rather than this false ceiling stuff. And I'm glad we did, because it's, sometimes the pyro people that came in, we were having to stop it because it was with the young bands, because it was all they were doing every so often. Boom, and the pyro stuff would go all over the place, and we sort of cancelled it out, except for bands like Stompers and stuff like that. You know, it had to be controlled by the right people, and a lot of them were just doing it for the fun and what have you. You know. And fun can be dangerous on them levels. Stuff when you're doing.
Absolutely. So I was gonna ask you, like, when you guys were out there on the road a lot, what was the size of your crew like when you guys were at the biggest? Did you have an LD and a sound guy? And how did your biggest crew work? How many people did you have?
At the height of the band, I believe we had a crew guy for every guy in the band. So it was that, and, you know, we had sound, lights, probably a monitor guy, you know, and then like a tech for every guy in the band, you know. Maybe Dave and Jeremy, because they both play keyboards, they might have had one guy them. But I think maybe at the height we might have had 6-7 guys. That was like really, really at the height, you know. But most of the time it was like 3 or 4 guys got it done, you know.
Right. Of course.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I seem to remember. It was like that, you know.
Was a big crew for back then. That was definitely a big size crew for, especially for a local band.
It was a huge crew for a local band. I mean, with Fleetwood, there was only eventually the maximum was three. It was me, Dennis, who drove them, who picked them up and what have you, and then Chris who worked with me doing the sound and lights and everything he could on stage and what have you. And he just did the biggest show of the year last year, the Beyonce show, with 128 semis.
Oh, my God.
128 semis.
That's
Chris who worked with me. Chris was the production manager for the whole thing. And
Taylor Swift?
No, Taylor Swift wasn't as big as that Beyonce show. That Beyonce show.
That's what I'm telling you. Okay, Beyonce had a ton of production. You're right. Yeah, yeah, crazy.
It was all steel. There was 100 plus trucks of steel that were hung from the ceiling and cast up upside down. And it's a show. It's not necessary music like it we used to do, and like you used to do all the time, and you still do so.
If you're at that level, I mean, you got guys that come in and set everything up. All the guitars are tuned properly. The drums are set. The mics are, everything is perfect. You can literally walk off the bus and get on stage, and you're ready to go because of a really dependable professional crew. That's all they do.
Yeah, if you sit on the stage, listen to the Eagles, you'll see the guitar techs off stage and what have you, but they're playing. They're also playing with on the songs. You know how filling the songs out with more dynamics from the guitars. You know, there's a lot of that stuff going on, which is cool. But it's not on tape. It's not Memorex. But most of the shows that are shows, like Beyonce.
Yeah.
The only one that's not, believe it or not, is Taylor Swift. The biggest show like she's got, she's still doing live stuff, which is great.
Oh, yeah.
Which is fantastic, you know. And that, to me, is where it's at. We're live people, all of us. We like to see the live thing and create every day. It's not a matter of listening to the record and this, that, and the other. Oh, that was great. Well, what about that lick? Did we hear that lick in the show? Yes, you did.
Sure.
Because it's done by the same people or people in the band that has adopted it from like Steely. They had a lot of session guys in there, but the band itself was phenomenal. And the music was phenomenal and playing every night. I can testify it was just unbelievable. So you didn't need all this.
To the point, like Sal mentioned with Elwood, it's like, you know, there are, if you, some guys were just like naturals, right?
And exactly.
And the guys who are like, almost like the lifers, you can just pick up guitar and do anything. You know, it's in a strange way, you know, if one guy in the band is sick, you can actually have a guy, it happened for Aerosmith, it happened for a lot of bands where the bass player, he's out that night, he's sick, but hey, our techs are going to fill in. And sometimes the fans have no idea. Just, you know, and these guys are playing just as well as the actual musicians, you know?
Well, every gig that I did with Dawson Sound Company, and we had a tour with whatever group it was, the roadies and all the crew played and got me a sound check before the band even showed up. And when I got that together, and they were all happy with what they were doing on the road, roadies and individuals would be, it would be like interesting. I'd do. Linda Ronstadt and David Gray, who actually worked with me, and he was a good talented guitarist and good fun and stuff, would get up there and do the guitars and this, that, and the other, and sing and what have you. And it was always good because Linda would pop in and say, "What are we doing here? And we got you ready now. You just walk up there and it should sound like $1 million." Well, it did every day. It sounded like $1 million. Yet she still sat on the monitor a couple of times because her guitarist would just want to play Beatles songs and she wasn't getting anywhere with her sound check. I'm saying, so I had to put my foot down and start, "Hey, get up there and do this properly," you know, and that kind of stuff on the mics and fall back on the monitors. And then when she got it done properly, she was like, yeah, it's really good now. Not doing Beatles. Beatles songs, just sat on the monitor waiting for him to stop.
Oh, yeah.
But it's...
Yeah.
If you're on one plane, like you guys are with the Stompers, you're all as one, whether it be keyboards, whether it be bass, whether it be drums, whatever, and you and the guitar and stuff, you work together. You work together, and after the first song, usually, I don't mean in front of the audience, but the first song in sound check, if you do get a sound check, you know what where the room sounds like, you know what the feel and the vibe sounds like, so you know what you're going to project to these people. And that's the key to that whole thing. You know, not walking off the truck, off the bus or whatever these days, before it was out of a station wagon or something, coming straight onto the stage and playing where they could do that. Because the roadies will be set up and everything's done, and every one of them happy of what they hear.
Enough to have Dickie Doss as the house sound guy. You had a precious gift for sure. You know.
Well, we did our
best.
We did our best to do what we needed to do, and it's just like every one of you guys that you've had and it's worked with you still. I mean, Zeus is a worker. He loves to work and loves to do create. And that's the key. If you love to create, like, you're not going to stop. The Jeff Smalleys, the Sousas, all those kind of characters, they're still at it because they love what the band does. They love what the individuals do. And then they can get on their case when they mess up. I love it. Hey, you missed that note up there, you know, especially if they're a musician that's doing the crew. And I'm sure that's happened to you, Sal, a couple of times. What did he play that for? Did he play that for? That's a different tune, don't you? Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not in the wrong verse. I'm in the wrong place. Anyway,
yeah, I love him.
I love the whole thing about it. And you didn't have any ladies that worked with you, Sal, did you? Just all guys?
No. Yeah. I think wasn't for any particular reason, or it just didn't.
It wasn't there.
We just didn't run into any for our band. I think my friend Tom Hambridge, I think they had a woman working there for his band.
TH and the Wreckage.
Wreckage. Yeah, for a long time, and there was a I'm going to forget her name. She worked at the Paradise for a long time.
Sound
and monitors.
Yeah. It wasn't Laurie. It was Laurie does the drum tech. She was doing a lot of drum stuff. I forget it. Not Sandy, was it? No.
The Blur of Time, Dickie. Yeah. That's how I couch myself forgetting about people's names, unfortunately.
But we
remember them, though. We remember. You know,
well, it's interesting. I forget the names, but then when I see them, I go, "Oh my God, I haven't seen you in 50 years or something stupid." You know,
absolutely. I mean, that's how it really is, too. You know, I was just talking with you guys about this stuff. I'm thinking there was a period of time where we used to do double headers. We'd play somewhere in the afternoon, and somewhere at night. I mean, these guys were going morning until the end of the late at night, and then driving, you know, to another state. You know, we did that a million times, you know.
America's too big for what, you know. In England, we'd go out and we'd play a gig, say, at 8 o'clock at night, and then we'd go up to another gig and play around 3 in the morning. We actually have done 4 gigs a day. With Fleetwood.
That's amazing.
And it's just and even in 66, 67, I would have the Who, the Steam Packet with, you know, Rod Stewart, Julie Driscoll, Brian Auger, would come down, like they'd play up in Newcastle, they'd stop on the way and play another place, and then they'd play the all-nighter that we used to go. We have all-nighters from 11 till 7, 11 at night till 7
crazy.
In the morning. And the groups would pass through. And we get some of the top Hendrix, we get everybody playing that down there, you know. And it was just how it worked. It was, they're out on the weekend, and, we'll come down and see Argentina Terrace playing your club. We'll go watch them, and, well, why don't you play after them at 3:30 in the morning, you know, that kind of stuff. And the place is packed. There's nobody talk about channel days, and they were packed with, you know, some days was really packed. Well, every day at the Mojo Club in Sheffield was packed beyond belief. Every day. It was just out of control. And then when there were special people came, and you could touch Stevie Wonder on stage because you were 3 feet away from him. You know, that's how amazing. Wonderful it was, you know, to have that and the whole band, Ike and Tina Turner band on stage, the whole lot of them. It that kind of stuff was wonderful. There was no roadies on the road, just their quasi-manager at the time, or not even that. There was just somebody to look after Tina and whatever. But everybody just did their thing. They came on, they got dressed, did their thing and worked. And the instruments were...
I mean, things evolve over time, right? Like, to Sal's point, you know, to have 2 gigs in a day, you have to have a crew that you can depend on 100%. Because there's just no way a band can play and then go do everything before and after at each venue and get... You know, that's just impossible. So it was so... It just, again, kind of echoes the point of how really critically important those players were in the mix. You know, even they're off side stage, they don't get all the praise and whatnot, but the bands knew how important they were for sure.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
I mean, and then they drive over roundabouts like me and stuff like that. That's been overtired, you know, and then we had to go to an airport to put the gear on a plane to go to Belgium and stuff like that. And it was like, why are we putting it on this prop plane? It's going to fall into the ocean with this weight that we're putting on. And we had that and Keith Emerson and all, and Yes, and all them all on the, you know, with the organs everywhere and whatever, B3s and whatever. And we stuffed it all in this little plane. And then we all got on the plane. And instead of giving you a little nip, they gave us a bottle. Oh, whiskey here, a whole bottle. By the time we got off, and it's like 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, we're all trash still, you know, because we've just come from an all night gig straight onto a plane to play an all day gig out in Belgium. You know, it was chaotic. But you're right, Sean. The stamina that you have to do, but you see, people are looking. For me, for instance, driving and doing that. I was waiting for the first song. I was waiting to have it all set up and listen to that song. I could sit there and watch Peter and watch Danny and watch Jeremy every night. And the stuff that I saw was just and listened to just blew me away every night. And I'm in awe by working with it. You know, and I said, I can't believe this. It's just unbelievable music, unbelievable sounds, unbelievable feeling. And that's.
Let me ask you this. I know if we did this last time we had you on, so I know this is your second time with us, but do you have any? I know you have, you're still a busy guy. Let's just go from the roadie guys for a minute here. You're still out there doing new music. You got at least 2 different projects going on with the Amplifier Heads and the Peppermint Kicks. Maybe just give us a little bit of a background on what you're doing these days. Any upcoming shows you're aware of that are coming up in the spring?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing right now. Well, I'm currently in the studio finishing up a new Amplifier Heads record. I'm going back in to add some horns next week, and finishing up an Amplifier Heads record. And then, you know, the Peppermint Kicks record was doing really, really good, which is saying a lot in these times that we're in, because I don't even want to get into it, but things are so different. But it's doing great, and so we're hoping to play this summer. I just got off the phone this morning with our good friend Baron Woodfield, and we got a bunch of stuff coming up.
Yeah,
and so all of that'll be coming out pretty soon about where we're going to be. But yeah, as of right now, I'm just finishing up some stuff in the studio and writing new songs for the next Peppermint Kicks record. And,
well, that's cool.
Which is fine. You know, it's the dead of winter right now. I'd rather not be out going to any gigs at this point. So
I'm with you.
yeah. But in the spring and summer, I'm pretty booked up well, man, you know.
Awesome.
And so that's going to be cool. Thanks for asking. You know, this is great, being able to talk about these guys, and because, like I said earlier, you know, they seldom, if any time, got got the applause that the band did, you know. And but they were a very important part
of the
of all our lives and the show and what people saw and heard. And I think it's really, really great that we got to talk about some of these guys. I'm sure you're gonna speak with other people about their crews. You know, every band was like a club.
Yeah.
You know, the Stompers we had the same guys in the band for many, many years, and as well as the road crew. And I know it's the same for all the bands. You know, the Fools, great bunch of guys. I just spoke with them recently. They're going to be celebrating 50 years together, which is we congratulate them, you know. And I know that they had some key members of road crews over their history that were really important to them.
They've still got Jeff Morley. Jeff's still
doing... Yeah, man. So there you go. There you go. You know, and Chris, what the hell's his name? He's Chris Paul.
Paul.
Another good guy. Yeah. And Jeff. Yeah, great guys. All great guys. Yeah, so you know, there's so many different with each band was another group of guys that were important to that band. You
exactly.
Know what I mean? And sometimes they you know they were the same person, you know, but it's been a joy to talk about these guys. I think this was a great idea, Dink and Sean and.
Well, we're going to have to close
now. Let's salute the roadies.
Yeah, it's true. We're going to have to close down right now because we're end of time-wise. And I figured Sean did the right thing by asking what you're doing right now. And it's important that because, Sal, we've got over 750 downloads of this podcast right now.
Beautiful, great.
And people would take them on their phones or people would take them in their car and listen as they're driving along and having a laugh about what we yet about, but at the same time understanding, boy, it was good at that time. It's still good now because we're still creating. And that's what I'm hearing back from people as well, is that because, you know, and we are going to talk with Tom Hambridge and... get his stuff on the TH and the records. Plus, I know what he's doing now. I actually beat him on a few years ago. I got number one with the Fleetwood Mac, Shrine 69 on the blues album, and then and then Tom came up and started ticking me off. I said, "Oh, he's got a lot going these days." And then you got Robert Harris Arrell, who's doing Taylor Swift and stuff. Yeah. It's wonderful to see. Everyone that came out of that 80s era, whether they played the Channel or anywhere in Boston, everywhere in Cambridge and stuff like that, but there were Boston people that came out and they're still at it and still doing wonderful stuff. And roadies too. Come on, Martin Faber on the road, still running around the world. And I think it's wonderful. I just think it's wonderful if you can keep it up. When age catches up, it's a bit tough. I'm talking to myself.
Yeah. That's okay, Dick. I understand that. Please. Oh, man. Hail, hail, rock and roll, brothers.
Yeah, hail, hail. Oh, by the way, check out the new Fenders. They've got the old school sound on them if you want, and they've got all this new stuff. The new Fender amps, I'm like freaking out. They're really good. And after all these years, I still love the sound from them Fenders. You know, and an old WEM Dominator would be your key because that's the original thing that Marshall put out. He put out the Marshall amps. Well, they're actually WEM's amplifiers in a Marshall case.
Right.
And the sound of them, if you had a 50-watt Marshall like John McVie did, unbelievable sound out of that thing. It was just, like I said, it was a WEM inside the amplifier, and all Marshall did was change the surround and make his cabinets, but he had to still buy the speakers from WEM because there was nobody selling speakers to the individual companies at that time in the early 60s.
Crazy stuff, man.
It's the sound. It's the sounds that come out of this stuff. That's what you have perfected with your amplifiers and with this setup. And people, when they hear them notes, like American Fun, it's like, we know that lick right now. We know exactly what that is. And boy, it sounds, it still sounds great.
I'm still a Fender guy. I think back in those days, I was using two twins.
See, I know you
hooked up to each other. those were loud. I'm not using that much anymore. But
they're loud, but the thing we're not like ZZ Top. They have them off stage these days, and the sound system uses does the work.
Right, right.
But I still like the, just on that stage, like the old channel with the backs up there. I mean, you know, it was just like. Great sound coming off of that stage from individuals like yourself and collectively as the band, you know, it was great. Anyway, I'm yatting on about stuff and I'm going to let you yatted on and had a great time about the individuals that worked with you. And Sean's happy about it because that was a great thing to bring up. Let's talk about the crews because we've not done that, you know, and stuff. And I'm glad that you mentioned it last week and last time we talked. And I'm saying, oh, Sal's perfectly right. I still have to call Howard for you. Once I've done that, I'm gonna tell him where you are and you're doing well.
Please.
We're talking a mutual friend from the 70s, Sean. And,
awesome.
And he was our doctor, and he was a wonderful doctor. And that's all I know. And he looked after us all, you know.
Yep.
All right, on that note, I'm going to let you call it. And I thank you again, Sal, for a great interview again and a great yacht and what have you. And so you too, Sean. And we'll do more.
Always a pleasure, Dinkin. Always good talking to you as well, Sal.
A big pleasure. Love you guys.
Love you.
Rock and roll.
Love you. This is Two Pints in a Corner signing out.